Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Tuesday's hearings on California's Proposition 8 and the Defense of Marriage Act before the Supreme Court that some analysts suggest could be as divisive as the landmark abortion ruling Roe v. Wade, in the sense that legalizing same-sex marriage will likely have profound social implications that could plague our politics. Aziz Haque, a professor of law at the University of Chicago, who clerked on the Supreme Court for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, joins us. Then we'll examine the deepening split in the Republican Party between those who want to be less ideological and more inclusive and those who believe that the party should be more ideologically conservative. Alan Lichtman, a distinguished professor of history at American University and author of White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, joins us to discuss the fate and future of the recent autopsy by the RNC that right-wing Republican activists have scorned. Then finally, we'll get an update on a country being torn apart from an expert on Syria, James Galvin, the author of The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. We will look into the implications of a rapprochement between Turkey and Israel and whether that portends some joint military action as concerns over a collapsing Assad regime with a large chemical weapons arsenal grows. Joining us now is Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk at the Supreme Court for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Haque.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And what's your sense, then, of some of the analysts like Adam Liptak in the New York Times saying that the shadow of Roe v. Wade looms over this ruling on gay marriage that the hearings begin tomorrow in the Supreme Court?
I think that advocates of equality for people who are gay or lesbian or transgendered have always thought about Roe v. Wade and the perception that Roe v. Wade catalyzed a popular backlash against abortion rights in developing their strategy. And that's certainly been true with the litigation around marriage equality, and it's certainly going to be something that's in many people's minds tomorrow and Wednesday when the Supreme Court takes up in oral argument these cases. And I think the question that people might want to kind of use as the place to start their thinking about it is, was there really a backlash after Roe v. Wade?
Well, this backlash has already been brought up by the very judge who overturned Proposition 8, the federal judge Vaughn Walker in the Federal District Court in San Francisco. During closing arguments in the case, Judge Walker said that the Roe case has plagued our politics for 30 years because the Supreme Court had ultimately constitutionalized something that touches upon highly sensitive social issues. Isn't the danger, Judge Walker then asked the counsel for those who want to overturn Prop 8, Theodore Olson, who was challenging the ban, isn't it a danger not that you are going to lose this case either here at the Court of Appeals or at the Supreme Court, but that you might win?
The concern that Judge Walker raises is the concern that it actually conflates two different things. One is, it's a concern that change, if change happens too fast, produces countervailing, retrogressive movements. And second is the idea that if change is done by a court rather than by democratic bodies like Congress or state legislatures, then the mere fact that a decision is taken out of people's hands will lead to a backlash. And Roe v. Wade is kind of the poster child for these ideas. And the problem with using Roe v. Wade in the way that Judge Walker did, and Judge Walker ruled, by the way, eventually in favor of marriage equality in that case, the problem with invoking Roe v. Wade in that way is that it's not at all clear that that's what happened. A number of scholars have pointed out that there was, in fact, a great deal of resistance to abortion prior to the Supreme Court's opinion. And it's not as if the opinion itself, when it was handed down, actually changes that much. Now, it is true that eventually Roe v. Wade gets taken up by people like Phyllis Schlafly on the right and becomes part of a broad political platform of the Republican Party and the right. But it's not clear that if Roe v. Wade hadn't happened, there wouldn't be something else that would have played something like the same role. So that we would have had a backlash against women's equality along gender lines, a backlash against reproductive freedom, all things that were going on in the 60s and early 70s anyway, regardless of what the Supreme Court did. We might have seen that backlash happening just with different placards, different signs, different slogans. And so the idea that Roe v. Wade played this really important role in the development of a reactionary movement against abortion, against reproductive freedoms, and against gender equality, I think it's really not clear that it did. And I think it's certainly not clear that today, were the Supreme Court to rule in favor of some kind of equality right with respect to marriage, and there's a whole slate of ways in which that might happen out of the cases that are being heard over the next couple of days, it's not really clear that we're going to see any kind of mobilization on the part of the conservative movement. Certainly possible that we might see it, but to predict the social consequences of a Supreme Court decision, I think, is much, much more difficult than many people think.
Again, I'm speaking with Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He is a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course, champion of women's rights, has said about Roe v. Wade that it's not that the judgment was wrong, but it moved too far too fast. And she also suggested that the Supreme Court in 1973 should have struck down only the restrictive Texas abortion law before it broadened it out into the ruling it became. So give us a sense of what your former boss is trying to tell us there.
Right. So she is making a point about the speed with which social change happens. And she's not making a point about whether it ought to be the courts as opposed to a legislature that brings social change, nor is she arguing with the fundamental legal principle at issue in Roe v. Wade. I think the way that she would have approached it had she been the lawyer for Roe in that case, and obviously she was litigating a sequence of cases about gender equality at the same time that Roe was decided in the early 70s. What I think that she's saying she would have preferred is to seek a narrower ruling that applied only to the specific law at hand, and then to build upon that narrow ruling over time in ways that made the court's ruling seem more incremental, more careful, and therefore more thoughtful and justified. And it's certainly plausible that kind of approach would have led to less public backlash. But with all due respect to my former boss, who I think is right about almost everything, I'm not certain that's the case. I think there's lots of instances that one can think of in which particularly reactionary movements see any small concession to the other side. So the idea that, you know, in a textbook in Arizona that you would teach something about the history of migration of Latinos to the United States, they see that little thing as a sign that, oh gosh, we're about to balkanize the races in Arizona, and, you know, this is the beginning of a new form of segregation or a Latino power movement or something. So the people all the time perceive even small changes as the nose of the camel in the tent, the beginning of the slippery slope or what have you. And we often see dramatic political conflict over things that are in essence symbolic. Right, we you know, on these sort of issues, we've seen this with respect to funding for public health work overseas. Think about the conflicts over federally funded art, things like Andrea Serrano's painting. So I'm not sure that even had the Supreme Court moved slower and issued a narrower ruling, I'm not sure that somebody like Phyllis Schlafly couldn't have turned around and said, hey, this is an opportunity for us to mobilize our base and really go out and say the Supreme Court's about to wreck American womanhood. And I don't think that somebody like Phyllis Schlafly cares enough about the precise meets and bounds of the Supreme Court's opinion to really change their behavior if the court moves slower rather than faster.
So, Aziz Haq, of course, it's a different world today from 1973 with a younger generation that's sort of post-sexual and post-racial, and the environment is quite different. The social environment is quite different.
Yeah.
What do you think is, though, in terms of overturning Prop 8? You suggested that there are a number of options that the Supreme Court has.
That's right. So I'll give you three different approaches. So the first approach is that the court could say what California did in granting and then rolling back same-sex marriage was not allowed. And they would focus upon the rolling back of a right that's been given where there was no evidence that that right had any kind of harmful side effects. Right? That would be a very narrow ruling because it would only apply to the facts of California. The second ruling, which would be slightly larger, I believe it would encompass either 8 or 9 states, would say, well, if you're a state and you allow for civil unions, but you don't allow for marriage, and the only difference between those two things is the label marriage, then you don't have a good reason to withhold that label. There's no permissible reason that you have for saying X is a civil union and Y is a marriage, and therefore, if you as a state have civil union, you have to allow for same-sex marriage. That would affect 8 or 9 states. It's a slightly broader ruling. It applies across, obviously, to a larger geographic area. And then the broadest ruling of all is to say that the Equal Protection Clause applies to people of different sexualities in a way that makes it illegal for any governmental unit, be it a state or the federal government, to deny a benefit such as marriage on the basis of sexual preferences. And that would be an extremely broad ruling. It would require every state in the country to, in essence, turn around and install same-sex marriage. If you were to think about the application of the sort of the Ginsbergian concern in this case, right, it's the idea that if you turn around in June when the case is handed down and say, right, Alabama, you have to allow for same-sex marriage, it's requiring an awful lot of transition in a very short time. And that transition might itself have costs in ways that spark political opposition. So, and whereas the first two options are picking out in some fashion those states in which there's already a substantial constituency for marriage equality and saying, yeah, you move forward and you do this, but it's very hard to see how that legal principle can over time be cabined to just those states. So I think even if the Supreme Court just opens the door here, it's very hard to see how over time the court doesn't have to step through the door.
So Aziz Haq, the other case, of course, the Defense of Marriage Act that's before the Supreme Court, the person who signed that, President Clinton, has disavowed it. And his wife, of course, has come out in favor of same-sex marriage, which would, I think, is a kind of indication that she's running for president, frankly. What is its fate, do you think?
Right. So the difference, just so your listeners understand, between the California case and the Defense of Marriage Act case is that in the California case, what's at issue is whether a state can grant or deny marriage licenses to people of the same biological sex. The Defense of Marriage Act, by contrast, is, as you alluded to, a federal statute that regulates when and how the federal government can recognize a marriage that is entered into under state law. Right, and this matters for benefits, for tax purposes, for inheritance purposes, matters for all sorts of things. Immigration, it's a really big deal. And the Defense of Marriage Act was signed by President Clinton at a time when no states recognized same-sex marriage. And so when he signed it, it had no practical effect because there were no states issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Now, obviously, today that's very different. And today, as a consequence of the Defense of Marriage Act, there are many states in which if you, as a same-sex couple, get a license to marry, and then you move across state lines, another state may not recognize that license, right? So that's that, and the federal government categorically will not. So if you're in one of the cases, there's people who were spouses worked for the federal government, and they didn't get benefits as they should have, right? Or in my view, as they should have. And what's at issue in the DOMA case is whether the federal government's decision to distinguish between valid state marriage licenses, depending upon whether it's a same-sex or opposite-sex couple, is lawful. And that's a much easier case for the court to decide, because the federal government, under President Obama, has said they think that the law is unconstitutional. It's relatively easy for the federal government to change its practices with respect to the definition of marriage. All it does is it has to say, okay, if there's a state that requires, that allows for same-sex marriages, we will now start to recognize those same-sex marriages. So it's a much easier and much lower stakes case to decide. There are also kind of technical legal reasons why a decision in favor of the plaintiffs in the DOMA case, striking down the law, doesn't necessarily lead to a ruling for gay marriage. You can acoustically separate them by kind of technical legal doctrinal reasons.
So just in closing then, Aziz Haq, in terms of handicapping the justices, I think you can safely say that Thomas and Scalia and Alito will probably vote against repealing DOMA and overturning Prop 8. But what about Kennedy and the Chief Justice? He seems to be, at least in the landmark Obamacare case, he seems to be indicating a certain independence.
We could differ over the Chief Justice Roberts and the landmark case. Yeah. But I think that they're very hard to read. The two things that I think are relevant to that question are, first, in the DOMA case, there is a states' rights issue. And insofar as there are states that are issuing marriage licenses, you know, Massachusetts, et cetera, and the federal government isn't recognizing those. And so it's in a sense, slighting the state. And so that kind of federalism, states' rights gloss, I think, is going to appeal to Kennedy. And it might make him sympathetic with respect to that case in particular. The second thing that's important to know is that there is, I think, a pretty powerful argument that the court ought to dismiss the California marriage case because it isn't within the jurisdiction of the federal courts under a fairly technical set of rules called standing. And the fact that there is that, what some might characterize as an out, right, because it just means the court can say, we don't need to rule on this, we're going to dismiss it, come back another day, give another 4 or 5 years, maybe the world will be different. You've got to factor that into your predictions about what the different justices are going to do.
Well, Aziz Haq, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haq, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk at the Supreme Court for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power at a Time of Terror. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the growing split in the Republican Party.
Ooh, love breaks the machine. Everything's half a dream. How can it be? Everything's born in shame. It's not just me. Particle wave duality. How can we ever evolve when our gods are so primitive? They destroy our hope for peace. Hope for love.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in line. doorway don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who's a distinguished professor of history at American University, who studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way of Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. His latest book is FDR and the Jews. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you, Ian.
And it seems that the autopsy that was done by the RNC that Reince Priebus had announced recently has been met with a lot of derision and scorn from the Republican right. And it sort of leads one to see this growing divide in that party. And as the Supreme Court takes up the gay marriage issue tomorrow, even more of a division you see in the party, particularly given that Priebus wants to reach out to the young and the minorities, and the young are sort of post-sexual in, as far as gay marriage is concerned. So, I mean, are they on a trajectory towards irrelevance?
Well, as you know, Ian, in my book, which was finished in 2007, published in 2008, my epilogue was called The Conservative Implosion. As early as 6 years ago, I was able to foresee that contradictions within the conservative ideological base, not anything liberals were doing, but internal contradictions, were going to cause enormous problems for the right and the Republican Party. I didn't predict they'd be headed to irrelevancy, although I thought that was certainly a possibility. But as you know, one of the reasons they're not irrelevant is the power of the Republicans at the state level, which has resulted in these tremendously gerrymandered districts. You have a state like Pennsylvania. That's an overwhelmingly Democratic state. It's a 5-to-10-point Democratic state, and yet Republicans have a substantial majority of the congressional seats. So for the foreseeable future, they may well have a base in the U.S. House and in the state governments as a result of reapportionment. They've also done reasonably well at the gubernatorial level. But at the national level, they absolutely are heading to irrelevancy. They have become a party bereft of any ideas, any solutions, internally divided, and the most they seem able to do is obstruct.
Well, of course, they also are a party, in terms of contradicting my notion of irrelevance, they're a party with unlimited funds from a lot of bilious billionaires who they, the Republicans in the House in particular, and the Senate, will go to the mat for.
That's absolutely right. You know, everyone talks about this wonderful grassroots Tea Party movement. I admire grassroots movements, whether from the left or the right. But, you know, as Deep Throat once said, follow the money. And you can see where the money is going into the Tea Party from the Koch brothers and other major corporate interests, because they know that the philosophy of the Tea Party is to let these people basically do what they please without any kind of supervision and regulation. And that's why so much money is going from major corporate donors to the Republican right. And that, of course, as you point out, helps them from becoming irrelevant as well. But they have huge contradictions that they have to deal with. And that Republican postmortem document didn't begin to deal with. I have three words for that document: empty, empty, empty. It talked about image, talked about messaging, it talked about fundraising, didn't even begin to touch upon the substantive policy contradictions that are at the heart of Republican troubles.
And it didn't really deal with this dichotomy that was so apparent at CPAC, where you have this sort of Jurassic Republicans that Reince Priebus referred to as stuffy old men. And then you've got these young up-and-comers, in particular Rand Paul, who won the straw poll, as his father had done before. So it seems to me that it's possible that one of two things is possible. Either Rand Paul will be the next nominee and the party will move into the libertarian direction, or it'll split up. I mean, either way.
Yeah, I think a split is much more likely. I'd be shocked to see Rand Paul nominated, because the Republican Party is at its core not libertarian. It's libertarian in certain regards. That is, it's libertarian in that it does not believe in economic regulation. But it is hardly libertarian when it comes to social regulation. The Republican Party is the party of anti-gay legislation, anti-abortion legislation, cracking down on pornography, support for police, support for the military. You know, it's not remotely libertarian in any of those regards, which is why Ron Paul, while he had kind of a fervent following, had a very small following, was never really able to dent the majority of the Republican Party. Every single major Republican candidate in 2012 was anti-choice.
Again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's a distinguished professor of history at American University, who has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. His latest book is FDR and the Jews. Now, I wouldn't dismiss Rand Paul altogether, because I've never seen a politician rise so quickly out of nowhere.
Barack Obama.
Well, that's true.
Even more quickly out of more nowhere.
Right, and he obviously has much greater and broader appeal, even though he's an African-American. But
right.
Rand Paul, you have to admit, his filibuster was a stroke of genius.
It was a stroke of genius. Great political theater, and it really got him some attention. But I just can't see the idea of libertarianism going anywhere within the Republican Party. It never had. And, the social conservatives, the national security conservatives, are so bitterly opposed, unless you get some kind of phony libertarianism, and that is that it's libertarian only with respect to economic regulation, but not with respect to the military, the police, and social regulation. That's phony libertarianism, and I certainly can see phony libertarianism going somewhere within the Republican Party.
So I guess, to make a somewhat comical analogy to what we're talking about, Alan Lichtman, it's just been recently revealed that during the Republican primaries that Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich apparently met secretly to form a joint ticket to block Mitt Romney, and they couldn't agree on who would be president and
who would be
vice president. And there you have the split between the social conservative and the more pragmatic. He's not a libertarian, but at least he's...
No, Newt Gingrich is no libertarian.
Right. But I'm saying that there you have it, that the social conservatives by nature just can't compromise, right?
No. How can you? They believe, that their position is divinely ordained and sanctioned. So there really isn't any giving up on that position, and that's at least a solid third of the Republican base that they cannot afford to alienate. Used to have a lot of pro-choice Republicans. You certainly don't anymore. As I said, the price of even running for president these days, if you're a Republican, has become you've got to be anti-choice.
So, we're talking about the future of this party that seems to be heading for a crack-up of some kind over both, it could happen in the short term, but it will certainly happen in the long term. But what happens to America in the interim? Because, what we have now is just unacceptable. I can't believe the American people aren't more outraged at the obstructionism of the Republicans. And
it's hard to believe, but, a dying warrior keeps flailing out, right? And the Republicans are going to keep flailing. They're not going to solve their contradictions. They've shown not the faintest sign that they are going to do that. There's not a word in that extensive document that points in that direction. So, like a dying beast, they're still going to be flailing out blindly and being obstructionist. There's no other path right now for the party. They have nothing else to offer, and the polls show that. You know, the Republican brand is, you know, getting close to where it was under Richard Nixon.
Well, but meanwhile, the country that's faced with some serious choices is going nowhere. And I'm surprised at how the Democrats have not seized on what we're talking about. They haven't seized on some of the absurd contradictions and the basic positions that the Republicans have taken.
It's pathetic. The Democrats, you know, are so weak. You know, the American people hates Congress overall. Congress has lower public standing than Attila the Hun. You know, it's 90% said they don't like the Congress. You can't get 90% of Americans to agree on the spelling of their name. Those polls are amazing. And yet, we keep electing exactly the same kind of weak need, unimaginative, place-holding professional polls to office. Look at Maryland. You know, we have one of the two or three bluest states in the country. Can you even tell me who we elected the last time to the United States Senate? Probably not, because no one knows. Ben Cardin, complete nonentity, in the safest seat in the country. We should have a leader, someone inspiring the people, someone taking on the Republicans. Instead, we have an overstuffed, you know, professional poll sitting and holding a place to no end. It's ridiculous.
But does that lead us to campaign finance, the fact that the plutocrats have captured our democracy and they own the Republican Party outright and they rent the Democratic Party?
Well, that's a huge part of it. You and I have talked about this many, many times. The problem is twofold. Number one, how are you going to get the very people that benefit from this outlandish system to get rid of it? And number two, how are you going to get reforms passed this conservative Supreme Court? You know, one of the untold stories about Republican obstructionism that people don't realize is the way they're obstructing Barack Obama's judicial appointments, not even letting them come up for a vote. One judicial appointee to the D.C. Court of Appeals just withdrew because the Republicans wouldn't even let her have a vote up or down. There are four vacancies in the second most important court in the land, and the Republicans won't even allow votes on nominees.
Well, but that's because they control that court. And even the seat vacated by Chief Justice Roberts is still open. I mean, that's how bad it is. And that court just passed a extraordinary ruling where they overturned Obama's only way around the Republican obstruction with the filibuster in the Senate, and that is recess appointments. Now they've invalidated his recess appointments. So how come...
We're paralyzed, you know. And, you know, you can say the Republicans are obstructionists, but you've got to put a lot of blame on the weak-kneed Democrats. Ian, look at the United States Senate. Can you tell me one figure in the United States Senate who is truly inspirational? I can't think of a one since the death of Ted Kennedy. Where are the great United, where are the Daniel Websters, the Paul Douglases, the Ted Kennedys? They're gone. There's placeholders there.
Well, you've also
got exactly what we don't need.
Right, and you've also got a majority leader in Harry Reid who got snookered by Mitch McConnell. I mean,
over the
filibuster reform. So this is the part of it that I don't understand. And somebody recently said to me on the air here that the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is in as much as conservatives in this country are proud to be conservatives. They call themselves conservative. Remember, Mitt Romney said he's a severe conservative, whereas no liberal in this country is prepared to call themselves a liberal. I mean, isn't that the disparity?
That was the Michael Dukakis, you know, the card-carrying liberal member of the ACLU. And, of course, all of the mindless punditry attributed those negative attacks to his defeat. Those things had nothing to do with his defeat. And yet, since then, the word liberal has been radioactive. One of the things that I think is most pernicious in this country is after-the-fact punditry. These pundits who have no idea how elections really work, after the fact, will give you all of these reasons why candidates won or lost based on absolutely nothing. So Mitt Romney ran a really bad campaign. Well, 2% of the vote had shifted, and Mitt Romney had won the election. Those same pundits would be saying Mitt Romney's brilliant campaign. And, you know, so we get all of this worthless stuff, you know, coming out, particularly after elections, that somehow politicians want to take seriously.
Well, what do you think then would ever revitalize the Democratic Party and bring about the very thing that you're asking for there, Alan Lichtman, and that is real leaders and politicians, particularly in the United States Senate?
Right.
What would happen, I mean, short of taking the money out, which is the core problem?
Leave that aside. That, of course, is important. You know, change has occurred in this country typically under two circumstances. One, a terrible crisis, the Great Depression, the Civil War. Or two, a major grassroots movement. I think the only thing that's going to change and move the Democratic Party is a revival of a grassroots movement. Would we have had the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 without the Civil Rights Movement? Would politicians have done all of that on their own? Not hardly. That is, I think, what it's going to take.
Well, Alan Lichtman, from your lips to God's ears, I don't see the activism. The Tea Party's still active. They still control the Congress. The Occupy movement fizzled. So we can hold our breaths and hope that something revives political activism.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's a distinguished professor of history at American University, who has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, and his latest book is FDR and the Jews. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about when the agony in Syria will end.
Bruce Rodner!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J!
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu!
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin!
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich!
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith!
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And what do you make of the rapprochement between Turkey and Israel that was brokered by President Obama? Is that a harbinger of Israel and Turkey working together to do something in Syria, which is pretty much what Prime Minister Netanyahu said? It's all about Syria.
Well, I think there are two things that are important about this. First of all, I don't think we can take Netanyahu at his word. He's a very good politician, which means that after months and months of blaming Turkey for the incident that caused the severing of relations, that all of a sudden now he turns around and says, look, it's Israel's problem. So I'm not sure exactly why he was saying what he was saying, did what he did. The other thing, though, is that, again, I'm not sure that this is a precursor to any action that's going to be taken by Israel or by Turkey. I would look at it more as a preventive measure that they're taking in order to shore up the two borders of Syria, which have been hemorrhaging over the last couple of weeks or so. There are refugees in Turkey, for example, and just the other day there was an exchange of gunfire over the border of the Golan Heights. So I think that both Turkey and Israel are looking at an imploding neighbor and thinking to themselves, what we have to do is to ensure some sort of coordinated measures in the future if necessary.
Well, it seems in terms of affecting the neighborhood, that already it's affecting Lebanon, right, with the resignation of the prime minister?
Oh, absolutely. And there is all sorts of difficulties that are taking place in Lebanon at the present time at the Syrian border. Hezbollah, for example, is a strong supporter of the Assads and the regime, and has been in conflict with, for example, opposition military that's crossed over the border seeking sanctuary or to perform raids into Syria. At the same time, Lebanese Sunnis have been working with the opposition in Syria as well, creating friction with Hezbollah in Lebanon. So there's a danger here that the Syrian situation is going to not only expand into, for example, Lebanon, but, for example, Iraq as well. A raid took place, for example, several weeks ago, in which Syrian opposition forces killed Syrian soldiers who had sought sanctuary in Iraq.
They killed a whole busload of them, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Right.
Yes.
So there's a few things going on there. You had the shootout with the Israelis and the al-Nusra people on the buffer zone on the Jordanian Golan Heights border. You've got Secretary of State Kerry went to Iraq to try and get Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to stop allowing Iranian overflights, where the Iranians are more than doubling down supplying military equipment to the Assads. And they seem to be, compared to the West, at least Iran has a kind of a pretty clear policy. Is this doubling down that the Iranians are doing, is it going to be enough to save Assad?
I think there are two things overall that are going on. On the one hand, you have an accelerated implosion taking place within Syria itself. Several weeks ago, for example, the opposition were able to not only take but hold on to a provincial capital, which is the first time they were able to do that. And that's a significant thing. They were notorious for not being able to hold on to territory before. So Syria is accelerating in its decay. At the same time, the United States is flailing about attempting to find some sort of policy that is going to be short of military intervention that will enable the United States to somehow put more moderate elements on top within the opposition itself in Syria. And it's not having much of an effect in Syria. We see this, for example, with the establishment of a transitional government, for example, and the resignation of the head of the coalition at the same time. It's an extraordinarily fractious opposition that we have, and the United States has not been able to somehow mold that into a coherent unit that would be pro-American, pro-West.
Now, the opposition leader you're talking about with the Syrian National Coalition, Ahmed Moaz al-Hatib, he resigned in frustration with the West because he said they were more obsessed about the length of the Syrian fighters' beards than they were about supplying them, where they're so overmatched by Assad's military and particularly the Air Force. But he offered talks with the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, on a condition that 160,000 prisoners are freed. He had his own problems within his own opposition. And so what do you make of the new lead of the opposition, that the American educated leader? Do the fighters in the field in any way report to him?
The short answer to that is no. The problem that the politicals, particularly the exiles, have had in terms of the Syrian opposition has been that there's a disconnect between the political apparatus and the military apparatuses. And I say apparatuses simply because the military still is not a coherent grouping. There are all sorts of factions that are disconnected from each other. So there's no real chain of command within the military. So the transitional government itself has very little power. The very fact that they chose somebody who had been living for decades in the United States, I think, demonstrates the fact that this is not a serious attempt to form a government.
So, again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, who is a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. So, is this Salafist element that we seem to be concerned about with the al-Nusra Front, is it really as big a phenomenon as it's being reported? I mean, is that the reason why the U.S. seems to be kind of unsure about what to do? They seem to always know what they don't want, but they've never been able to express what they do want. Although my understanding is that the CIA have some people in there in Syria that are training and I presume arming certain rebel factions. So what is this mosaic of the Syrian opposition, the rebellion? Do you have a kind of clear picture of it?
There is no clear picture of it. That's the problem. We don't know, for example, the strength of various elements within Syria that changes from day to day. We also don't know whether or not, for example, any of the pro-Western groups is actually going to gain, let's say, momentum, which seems now to be in Nusra's hands. The thing about, to answer your question, your previous question about the size of the jihadis within Syria, the number of jihadis within Syria, it doesn't really matter. These people have an incredible ability to cause trouble. I mean, for example, when a ceasefire was brokered over an Islamic holiday, the idea being that both sides, the government and the opposition, were going to lay down their weapons for the term of the holiday, Jabhat al-Nusra refused to abide by it, and immediately the ceasefire broke off. So the numbers don't matter. Remember, it took only 19 people to wreak such havoc in the United States. So that's sort of the equivalent of what we're seeing now in Syria.
So what's your day after scenario then, James Galvin? I mean, based on the assumption that the Assads are going to fall eventually, and of course Hillary Clinton and others have said some time ago they were going to fall, and they're certainly taking their time about it.
Well, that's the thing. They're certainly taking their time about it. So one thing that we've learned throughout the Arab uprisings has been that we shouldn't make predictions on these things. There are all sorts of extraneous things that we are not even thinking of at this point, which might come into play, foreign intervention, et cetera, et cetera. But I would leave it with three possible scenarios for Syria. It's going to be the regime is going to crush the opposition, which seems unlikely at the present time. The opposition is going to crush the regime, which is possible. Or there's going to be a protracted stalemate, which we're seeing right now, actually. Now, this sounds rather banal, but think about the way in which, for example, the Egyptian and Tunisian uprisings ended. They ended with military intervention, one part of the regime turning on another part. That will not take place in Syria. Or Libya and Yemen, with the regime just simply falling apart. That also will not take place in Syria. This regime is going to stick together to the bitter end, that bitter end will either mean a victory for the regime, a victory for the opposition, or it'll continue as it's continuing now with this continued decay in Syria.
Well, but isn't it possible, and in fact likely, that the Alawites will retreat to their ancestral homeland on the northern coastal mountain area?
Well, that's been mooted, but I would draw people's attention to a number of factors. First of all, the so-called ancestral homeland, for example, the city of Latakia is majority Sunni, not Alawite, although the rural area is majority Alawite. It's a very mixed area, so there really is no homogeneous Alawite homeland. The other thing is that if, for example, the situation got so bad that the regime decided to retreat to a Alawite homeland, what would prevent the opposition, which would then obviously have the upper hand, from continuing the fight and preventing the regime from becoming ensconced there as well? One thing about the Middle East state system is that as fragile as it appears from the outside, as artificial as it appears from the outside, it's held up remarkably well. And one of the reasons for that is because nobody from the outside wants to see that state system to be remixed again. Nobody would be able to agree on borders, et cetera, et cetera. So there is going to be a single Syria coming out of this. But the question is whether or not it's going to be a real state or whether it's going to be a state like Somalia.
Well, James Galvin, we started out talking about the rapprochement between Turkey and Israel brokered by President Obama and what that means, particularly in terms of Syria. What about the scenario that has often been suggested that the red line for the Israelis are the chemical weapons being Assad's arsenal being transferred to Hezbollah, and there's already been an Israeli strike against what was seen as a convoy carrying surface-to-air missiles from Assad's apparently fairly substantial inventory into Lebanon. So that seems to be an active possibility. How much is that going to throw a monkey in the wrench?
Well, that is very much of a possibility. Obviously, there have already been cases in which the Israelis have intervened with airstrikes, for example, and back-and-forth artillery duels which have taken place. But I think what we have to do is step back a little bit and understand that every time this occurs, it's a propaganda boon for the Assad government, and the Israelis understand that. The Israelis understand that Assad has been saying from the very beginning that this whole uprising is nothing more than a foreign conspiracy. And it's a conspiracy of jihadis, of Al-Qaeda, of Saudi Arabia, of the United States, of Israel. You know, the list goes on and on. Lebanon, et cetera, et cetera. This would only put give more evidence to the Assad propaganda. So I think the Israelis have been, as much as they can possibly have been, they've held back and have only intervened in situations in which they have felt that there was something that immediate action was required.
Well, but doesn't that lead to the conclusion that a desperate Assad will play the Israeli card? He will try to transfer the chemical weapons to Hezbollah or the surface-to-air missiles, inviting the Israelis in. That may be his last card to play.
Well, that might be his last card to play. I mean, there's been all sorts of speculation about Assad using those chemical weapons himself, not transferring them in to anybody, but actually using them against the opposition. There is still a potential for the intervention from the outside against Assad that would be strike quite a blow against the regime if chemical weapons were used. The ability to degrade the army further, the ability to prevent the Air Force from actually using the flight over Syria, et cetera, et cetera. There is a capacity to do that without putting boots on the ground. So I think that the Assad family and the wider regime is actually holding out, reluctant to use chemical weapons for that very reason, that would be the final blow that the military of the regime would suffer from.
Well, just in closing, James Galvin, what's your sense of whether or not this will end up being a reversal for Iran and for Hezbollah, which seems to be the conventional wisdom? And it also, the suggestion is that the fall of the Assads could create a kind of domino effect in Iraq, where the Sunni are very, very restive, and so are the Kurds. So will this really be a big blow? Because my understanding is that within Iran itself, a lot of the Iranian people are fed up with the enormous amounts of money that have been spent on Hezbollah and bailing out the Assads.
Right, particularly with the sanctions on Iran, the Iranian economy is not doing particularly well. But I think before we begin to gloat and look at, for example, this is a bloody nose for Iran and that whole alliance between Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and formerly Hamas, which has now defected from the alliance, and Russia as well. I think we should take a step back and see exactly what we're getting ourselves into at the present time, which is the possibility of no government control over large swaths of Syria, which means the possibility for jihadi emirates to establish themselves there, the possibility for a long simmering conflict taking place among rival sects within Syria, the possibility of a protracted civil war that would create even worse of a humanitarian crisis that we have going on right now. It's about 25% of the Syrian population are either internally or externally refugees, have been killed, or have been imprisoned. So what we're talking about is a population that has been extraordinarily brutalized and at the same time a country that appears at the present time to be going the way of Somalia.
Well, James Galvin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he is the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Bye for now.